Hello, hello. My name's Brandon, if you haven't met me yet. And today's Bible passage will be from Job 33. So feel free to open up your own Bibles or follow along with the slides. But now, Job, listen to my words. Pay attention to everything I say. I am about to open my mouth. My words are on the tip of my tongue. My words come from an upright heart. My lips sincerely speak what I know. The Spirit of God has made me the breath of the Almighty. The breath of the Almighty gives me life. Answer me then. If you can stand up and argue your case before me, I am the same as you in God's sight. I too am a piece of clay. No fear of me should alarm you, nor should my hand be heavy on you. But you have said in my hearing, I heard the very words, I am pure, I have done no wrong. I am clean and free from sin. Yet God has found fault with me. He considers me his enemy. He fastens my seat in shackles. He keeps close watch on all my paths. But I tell you, in this you are not right. For God is greater than any mortal. Why do you complain to him that he responds to no one's words? For God does speak, now one way, now another, though no one perceives it. In a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls on people as they slumber in their beds, he may speak in their ears and terrify them with warnings, to turn them from wrongdoing and keep them from pride, to preserve them from the pit, their lives from perishing by the sword. Or someone may be chastened on a bed of pain with constant distress in their bones, so that their body finds food repulsive and their soul loathes the choicest meal. Their flesh wastes away to nothing, and their bones, once hidden, now stick out. They draw near to the pit, and their life to the messengers of death. Yet, if there is an angel at their side, a messenger, one out of a thousand, sent to tell them how to be upright, and he is gracious to that person and says to God, spare them from going down to the pit. I found a ransom for them. Let their flesh be renewed like a child's. Let them be restored as in the days of the youth. Then that person can pray to God and find favor with him. They will see God's face and shout for joy. He will restore them to full well-being, and they will go to others and say, I have sinned, I have perverted what is right, but I did not get what I deserved. God has delivered me from going down to the pit, and I shall live to enjoy the light of life. God does all these things to a person, twice, even three times, to turn them back from the pit, that the light of life may shine on them. Pay attention, Job, and listen to me. Be silent, and I will speak. If you have anything to say, answer me. Speak up, for I want to vindicate you. But if not, then listen to me. Be silent, and I will teach you wisdom. Here ends the reading. I will pass to Tim now for the sermon.
Good morning. So my name is Tim, and I'm a trainee here at the church. Thank you, Justin. What a passage we have before us this morning. Just to let you know that we're going to be doing a bit of jumping around. So if you are good at Bible flipping, I encourage you to flip through. So there will be chapters 32 to 37. But also just be kind to your neighbor as well. If you see them struggling to find a passage, maybe just show them across as well for them. But if you're struggling to find the passages, it's okay. Listen to me reading it and just hold it before you, chapter 33, because this is a very important chapter. Why don't I pray? Father, what a privilege it is to preach your word to your people. I'm your servant, so make less of me and more of you. Open our ears and our hearts to hear your word today. Amen. What is your favorite memory as a child? So I remember when I was little, my family would took me on ski trips, and my cousins would tag along with me as well. And it's like the best thing ever. Like, have you guys been to the snow? Yeah, so, but the thing is, to get there, right, there's a long car ride. And as kids, it was terrible. Like 2 hours in, we're tired, we're in pain. My cousin, she's car sick, and it's just horrible. So we sort of gone, and we start complaining, grumbling, and we said, well, when are we ever going to get there? It feels like eternity, right? But once we got there, once we got out of the car, we felt a fresh breeze in our lungs, and we felt the snow in our faces. The pain of the car ride was long gone, and all we felt was excitement. And the joy of our arrival has overshadowed the pain of the car ride. So in the past few weeks, we've been looking at the book of Job, and Job was a man on that painful journey. He was experiencing tremendous suffering, which threw him into a pit of confusion. Why is this happening to me? You see, for Job and his friends, they believe that the world is very black and white. It's very simple, right? You do good things, you get blessings from God. You do bad things, you get punished. But here's the problem. Job said, hold on, I haven't done anything that wrong. Like, what have I done to deserve this sort of punishment? Surely there's something wrong with God's way of justice. There's something wrong with the system. But his three friends, on the other hand, they uphold God's perfect justice in a way that is black and white. Well, God will never punish someone unless they've done something terrible. So Job, you know, you've obviously sinned, just confess it before it's too late. So they engage this ongoing back and forth debate, and it turns to a heated argument. And 31 chapters later, his friends gave up. They just fall silent. And Job is still just head full of steam, complaining to God, saying, why God, what have I done wrong? But here, out of nowhere, we see a young man named Elihu. This guy is interesting. Like, he's probably one of the most interesting persons in the Bible because there's nothing much said about him. And for 31 chapters, he's just been there silent, sitting there. But now, when he sees that his friends have finally shut up, he's like, oh, it's time for me to talk. So come with me to chapter 32, 1 to 5. But then Barachel's son, Elihu from Buz, one of Ram's descendants, got really angry. He was furious with Job because he had been declaring himself righteous instead of vindicating God. Furthermore, he was furious with his three friends because he had not answered Job, but instead condemned him. Elihu waited to have a word with Job, since the others were older than he. But when he saw that there had been no response from those three, he got even more angry. You know, it's how you go to a family gathering and you're the youngest, you're always just sitting there quietly. That's like Elihu there. He's sitting there, he's letting his friends talk. But now, as he watches his friend Job slipping deeper and deeper into that pit of self-righteous anger, and that his friends were condemning Job without a cause, he was angry, and it fueled him to stand up and speak. So the question here is, before we actually get into the passage, we have to understand how we should read Elihu's words. Are they wisdom or are they foolishness? It's very important, right? Because then it's like, how can we then apply that to our lives if it's foolishness? Well, this is argued among the Christians of the scholarly world. But I want to argue that the text itself actually shows quite clearly that Elihu's words are in fact spirit-inspired wisdom. And a human version
of a prelude to what God himself has to say later on.
And just quickly, I'm just going to give you three reasons. Number one, so Elihu introduces a fresh new perspective that's quite different to Job's friends and quite consistent to what God has to say later on. We'll unpack that later. And number two, God actually makes a judgment of each person's words at the end of the book. And as a result, Job's three friends were rebuked for their folly. And that God does not rebuke Elihu. I think that's a good indication that at least what Elihu says are in fact truth about God. And three, Job becomes silent
as Elihu speaks, and he allows him to speak for 6 chapters. And keep in mind that Job, he is on the roll. He just destroyed his friends, and no one can tell him now what to do. He's on his head full of steam, you know, going about his complaining. But now as Elihu speaks, even though we saw in the chapter, he encourages Job, Job, tell me if you have any answer, let me know, and I'll listen to you. But Job had nothing to say. I think what Elihu has said has struck a chord in Job's heart. And he says, look, what you said makes sense. I think it's wise. So Job outlines 3 important truths about God that I want to highlight. And the first one is that God is righteous above all. So after a few words trying to earn a hearing from Job, Elihu gets straight to the heart of Job's complaint. So come with me to chapter 34, verses 5 to 6. Now, this is Job's complaint. Even though I am innocent, God has stopped treating me righteously. Have I lied concerning the justice I deserve? My wound is incurable, and though transgression cannot be attributed to me. So in his suffering, I hear that Job's self-justification comes so close to accusing God of injustice. And this concerns Elihu. So he opens his rebuke with the truth that God is more righteous than Job or anyone else. So chapter 35, 1 to 2. Are you saying that it's just for you to claim I'm more righteous than God? And down in verse 5, observe the heavens. Take a look around. Look, the clouds are higher than you, aren't they? So let me turn your attention to the pole there at the end, if you can see it. On top, there's a few tapes. Anyone know where that's from? Here, a few laughter. So I've heard from the FI leaders that was a game that they played. Someone's going to clean that up, though. It's probably pretty hard. It's pretty high. So the game they played was that who can jump the highest, right? So they got a tape, and they're trying to jump and then put the tape at the highest point of where they can reach. Who remembers the winner of the competition this year? Jimmy? I heard Jimmy was the defending champion, but I heard there's a new winner this year, Zenith. Zenith, can you stand up? So Zenith is quite tall, and he plays basketball. He's quite athletic. Who thinks he can jump higher than Zenith? Oh, Ying, okay. I don't know about that, Ying, but you eat too much KFC. Okay, so can Zenith touch the ceiling? Probably not. In fact, I don't think LeBron James can touch the ceiling. I don't think Michael Jordan in his prime can touch the ceiling, right? Or maybe he can, but you know, the old timers will say, oh yeah, Jordan definitely could. But I don't think so. So you see, it's all about perspective. If you say, okay, this guy jumps high. The same goes with righteousness. You see, we measure our righteousness, human righteousness, by the centimeters. But God's righteousness is up in the heavens. Right? How can we even comprehend that? So in fact, when the Bible talks about someone being righteous, you see that all across the Old Testament. It doesn't mean that they are morally perfect, just like God. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, they're morally corrupt people in many ways. But they were made righteous by God through his promise and their trust in God's promise. Same as Job. Job is described as righteous in the story, but he's not perfect. He's made righteous by God, and God himself finds favor in him, and he has a faith. He puts his trust in God. The gospel today is the same. On this side of the cross, we see that the gospel is all about sinners being made righteous by God through faith in Jesus and not by our own moral perfection. God has not changed. Have you ever felt like you are so righteous, you know, like something happens to you, and you're like, how can this be right? God, how can this be right? Isn't that the same as saying that I'm more righteous than God? So Elihu follows this up by the proclamation that God's sovereignty is above all creation. So it's point 2. In chapter 37, 5 to 6, he says, God thunders his wondrous voice. He does awesome works that we don't comprehend. For he says to the snow, fall to the earth, and he tells the rain, pour down, and it rains profusely. God has total and absolute control over everything all the time. In contrast, Job doesn't, and we don't. Job cannot see into the mind of God, and he doesn't know how things work like God does. Who is he then to question God of how he does things? Are we like that sometimes? When things don't happen the way we want it to happen? Or you don't get the job that you so long for? You like this girl or this boy, but they don't like you back? And you say, what? I planned all this. How can this happen? God, what the heck? But the thing is, you know, we don't know, right? How can we question God of how he does things? So, okay, you look at me now, I think it's hard to see, but when I was a kid, I was very chubby, very chubby. And my friend used to make fun of me. And even worse, in family gatherings, my family used to make fun of me. My auntie would be like, oh, look, so fat. And it's like, so mean. But, so one time, so I went with my parents to the mall, and I was being quite obedient to them, right? And I was expecting a bit of a treat afterwards, because I know in my head, we drive past the Macca's. I was like, surely they will stop. But they didn't. So I was angry. How could you? But I think looking back, my parents saw way more than I did. They knew I was chubby and overweight. I was failing my PE classes. They knew that I was at Macca's like 2 days before that. And were late for my piano practice as well. So as you can see, looking back, I appreciate their love for me and that, yeah, they saw the big picture where all I could see was chicken nuggets at the time. So God is righteous and he is sovereign above all. I think most people would read the book of Job and they will stop there. And I think it's okay. I think it gives you a good way to live in the sense that knowing that God is God and we are men, I'm just going to trust God in my seasons of suffering. But I think that the book of Job actually offers much more, especially through the words of Elihu. I think Elihu's wisdom gives God's people comfort and a closure in the depth of their suffering. See, God paints a picture for his suffering people, a picture of hope and redemption. So here's his third point. God saves and sanctifies the righteous through suffering. So chapter 36, it talks a lot about God's justice, and it's kind of, you hear this throughout the Old Testament. There's nothing new, seemingly. And the way that God is, he has his eyes on the righteous and he shuns evil. But verse 8 and 9, if you can come to me there, chapter 36, there's an interesting idea. Here he's talking about the righteous. If they're bound in chains, caught in ropes of affliction, he, God, will reveal their actions to them. When their transgressions have become excessive, what he's saying is that I think Elihu, well, he is definitely the first person in the story so far to suggest this idea that the righteous can suffer and the righteous has transgressions just like the wicked. And what God does through suffering with Job is that he reveals his inner transgression. As you hear the dialogue of Job, as you hear him speak, he falls closer and closer into the pit of self-righteous anger. And that's his inner sin, his self-righteousness. And you notice that the narrator no longer says Job has no sin, because it comes mightily close to that line, doesn't it? But the thing is, that begs the question, is God going to judge Job for his sin? Is that why God has brought him to his suffering? Is it so that God can judge him? Well, come with me then. We finally land in this passage today, chapter 33, right? I'm going to read from verse 22. So here it talks about the righteous as well. They draw near to the pit and their life to the messengers of death. Yet if there is an angel at their side, a messenger, one out of 1,000, sent to tell them how to be upright, and he is gracious to that person and says to God, spare them from going down to the pit. I have found a ransom for them. Let their flesh be renewed like a child's. Let them be restored as in the day of the youth. Can you hear the gospel in that message? So God is the Redeemer. In this image of foreshadowing, we see there's a precious ransom being brought to God for his people, which guarantees God's everlasting presence and favor in their life. It guarantees that God will not forsake them in their suffering, and it guarantees a hope for the future of renewal in the midst of their suffering. And what is this ransom, you ask? Well, hold that thought. Glad you asked. But God not only saves through redemption, but sanctification. Come down to verse 28 to 30. He says, he has redeemed my soul from going down to the pit. My life will see light. Indeed, God does all these things again and again with a person to bring his soul back from the pit, to light him with the light of life. Salvation is a one-off gift, but salvation is also a process. Time and time again, God brings his righteous back from the pit of sin. That's how he saves them. He has a picture for them. He has a destination for them, and he will do anything to bring them to that place. So 36, 22 to 23, just quickly, I'm going to read this. Indeed, God is exalted in his power. Who is like him as a teacher? Who ordained the path for him? And who has asked him, you're wrong, aren't you? God is a living and active teacher. He rebukes, he disciplines, he humbles, he draws near to those he loves, especially through seasons of trials and suffering. You see, after about a year, after I became a Christian, life was cruising. It was great. I was doing well at uni. I went partying. I was doing my internships. But halfway through my internship, I got a call from my family. Turns out that my grandpa was at the last stage of his cancer, and I didn't know until then. So they gave me an emergency visa and said, look, you have to come, you have to come. I was like, yeah, of course. So I, halfway through my internship, I quit. And I said, look, sorry, I just have to go. And I was there with him. And I saw the pain and grief that he was going through. And it seemed hopeless. The shell of a man he once was. And the family was in grief, and the pain was real. We know that maybe tomorrow he will be gone. So in that moment, it's like a reality check had hit me. God took me back to thinking about what really is important in life. God took me back to why, to how he brought me to himself in the first place. The fact that, I was like, what is this life again? Took me back to thinking about life and death. And even more so than that, he gave me a mission. He gave me a conviction in my heart to preach the gospel to those whom I love, not wanting to see anyone perish. So God has good purposes for his people, even through suffering and evil. He does not deny his agency in all things, but instead he assures us that he's working for our good. And he understands our grief. Of course, pain is real. And our family, we still feel that today. But there's a joy in me, at least, to know that God is at work through all things. So Romans 8, 28 to 30. And we know that in all things, God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Those who God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brothers and sisters. And those he predestined, he also called. Those he called, he also justified. Those he justified, he also glorified. God is not only righteous and sovereign, he is a loving Father who works all things for the good of those he loves. And all things, of course, include suffering. God purposefully uses suffering and evil for the good of those he loves. See Jesus as he cries out on the cross. What suffering would he have been going through? But have you ever considered the grief of the Father in that moment as he sees his son, his beloved son, hanging on the cross, facing his wrath? But through the suffering of his son, God provides a ransom for his people, and he redeems us from the pit of our sin. God saves through suffering. And in our suffering, God takes away what we hold dearly in this world so that we can receive a greater treasure in knowing him. So my prayer is that in your suffering, God's love might pierce your heart in a way unlike any other seasons of your life. And he will take you back to the cross where his son was crucified so that you might be saved. In the darkest night, when you find yourself never be so comforted and assured that God loves you always, that ultimately your faith in him may be made stronger and deeper. See, God not only saves, but he sanctifies through suffering. Now, I think some of us here today, it will be, you're still investigating Christianity, and it's so exciting that you've come. And you might be feeling a little bit left out, because you're like, oh, God is so good to his people. What about me? Well, the good news is that Jesus Christ endured the greatest suffering so that you too can be made right with him. Here's the good news. Trust in him and you'll be saved. And you will be made righteous in God's eyes. Don't let this opportunity go by. Speak with someone here today. They'll tell you the whole story. But please, because God wants you to get right with him. And don't miss out on this beautiful reconciliation we have with him. And the good promises he makes to his people. Well, to us Christians, fear not suffering and trials. God is with you in the darkest night. Have assurance and comfort that God has a purpose in everything, a good purpose for those who love him. So in your darkest time, make sure that you search him, call upon his name, and wrestle with him. But don't let go, don't turn away, because God has never turned away from you, and he will never. If your friend is going through suffering, I think something that we learn from the book, the story so far, is that empathy and being there, your presence is so valuable. But at the same time, truth matters. Truth saves. Make sure that you find opportunity that you can speak the truth in love to them. They need to hear it from you. And I know some of you guys, I've been working with over the many years, months, maybe just weeks. I know how much some of you have suffered. And I just want to say that God has a picture for us. Right, standing at this side of the cross, it seems so clear. Even though back then, for Job, it would be like a little candle, like you try to find the answer. But for us, everything's so clear, and the picture is so clear to us. That one day, God will make all things new. A perfect world, with no sin, no suffering. He himself will be there among us, and he himself will wipe away every tear in your eyes, every tear from every affliction that you have in this life. We'll smile as we look back and see this momentary life, and we see the loving hand of the Maker being at work in every season of our life to bring us to where we are. And as you can say, as we finally hop out of the car, as we land our feet on the snow, as we breathe in the fresh air, as we feel the snow on our faces, the pain of the long car ride is far behind us. And the joy of our arrival will overshadow the pain that is in this life. that day is just around the corner. So let's look forward to it. Let me pray. Father, you are such a good God. We're all sinners, we're all clay, yet Lord, you have given us your Son. You have made us righteous. You call us your sons and daughters, and thank you so much for that. Lord, help us in our darkest days to see you clearly at work in us. And we help us to trust you, though our faith is failing. Help us to call upon your name, and help us to know that you have not left us. Help us to have a clear picture of what is ahead of us. Help us to long for the day where we will rejoice in the joy of our arrival. Amen.